This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. More than 100,000 Americans have died of opioid overdoses in the past 3 years. In New Hampshire, that number is more than 1,200, while 2017 state numbers project a small decrease in overdose deaths. The problem is still very front and center for a large number of Granite State families, but not for all. Wendy from Nashua asked our Only in New Hampshire series, what can Granite Staters who are lucky enough to be untouched by the opioid crisis do to help those who are? Well, there are a number of threads to pull when it comes to opioid addiction, treatment, and policy. Maya Sulovitz is a neuroscience journalist specializing in addiction who wrote about an unlikely key to understanding the overdose epidemic and an idea that is starting to get traction: social capital. Maya, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
So refresh us. What exactly is social capital?
Social capital is the bond or web of connections that people have to each other. It's the social bonds that sustain a community. And this sounds like something that is kind of airy-fairy that you could not measure, but it's measured in questions like, do you think people can be trusted or do you think you can't be too careful? It's also measured in things like civic participation, like voting, and in participation in voluntary and other local social organizations.
And some of those indicators you mentioned have been in sharp decline for a while. So what's the connection here between overdose deaths and social capital?
Well, basically, the less social capital you have, the higher your overdose death rate will be.
And is that a community-based thing, a location-based thing?
Yeah, it seems to be pretty much location-based, and it has to do with several different things. For one, opioids are in the brain. One of the functions that they have is to socially connect us to each other.
Mm-hmm.
When a mom interacts with her baby, the oxytocin system, not to be confused with OxyContin, but the oxytocin system wires her brain's natural opioids to be released when she's in the presence of the baby, so she feels good around her baby. And when our social bonds fray, which is what has been happening lately in a lot of places, the attraction of opioid drugs becomes greater.
It's interesting because some of the causes of the opioid crisis, a lot of things pointed to easy and cheap access to drugs, prolific prescriptions of pain medications, economic factors, lack of opportunity. But social capital, how does that play into this?
Well, that is kind of involved in many of those different things. For example, the prescribing rates for opioids in communities with really low social capital are higher. Now, we don't know if that's because people in those communities are going to the doctor and faking pain, or if they are actually having pain and having more pain because of the economic despair. That's very hard to sort out, but it's definitely the case that people are at higher risk of addiction when they lose a job, when they lose social status, when they don't have a source of meaning, purpose, and connection. So all of these factors are kind of deeply interrelated, and it becomes very difficult to say, well, did A cause B or whatever? But what is clear is that people's connection to each other is a really important way to reduce the risk of addiction in the first place, to help people who have addiction heal from it, and to also reduce the risk of overdose death.
Well, how about as to Wendy's question, what can a Granite Stater do to help people affected by the crisis? So what does social capital look like when it comes to addiction?
Sure. Well, I mean, one of the obvious things is that a lot of people with addiction go to support groups and help each other by creating new social bonds. But if you are somebody who is not directly affected, and that is rare, but if you are such a person and you want to help, the main thing that you can do is be kind, be connected and be participatory and work on activities that will increase community-level trust. And that, again, can sound kind of disconnected, but the thing about addiction is that it is characterized by isolation and shame and stigma.
Hmm.
And the way we've dealt with this as a society is to say, you people are criminals. We're going to lock you up. You don't have a medical condition. We don't care about you. We're just going to punish you and hope that that will stop you from doing stuff we don't want you to do. And that's a really terrible way to deal with addiction, which, by the way, is defined by compulsive behavior that continues despite negative consequences.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and addicts are known for being loyal to their drug more than to their family. You know, there's an inability to connect that is a hallmark of addiction. So how do you get over that?
So what's interesting about that is that partially that's a myth. It's certainly the case that people do kind of fall in love with the drug and prioritize that over everything else. But that does not mean that people with addiction are unreachable. The way people with addiction become unreachable, however, is if they think you're judging them and you won't have anything to do with them unless they immediately change their behavior. If you accept somebody exactly where they are and you treat people without judgment and without expectation that they're going to do something for you immediately, the change in the ability to connect with people with addiction becomes enormous. And this is why things like needle exchange programs and safe injection facilities are so powerful, because not only do they provide direct tools to reduce risk, but when you are an addicted person and everybody hates you and everybody blames you and you are seen as a liar and a manipulator and somebody you can't trust and a criminal, and somebody actually just treats you decently, it's such a shock. And it's such a different way of being interacted with that people open the door for change. I've seen this many times at these kinds of places where people who are just so marginalized and so down and out actually smile, and you've never seen them smile. And during that brief interaction, you can begin to make people feel valued. And if people feel valued, they can begin to value themselves, and if they do that, they can begin to progress towards healthier behavior. You know, it can sort of seem like, you know, you want to shake people with addiction and say, wake up, stop this, like, you're killing yourself, you're harming your family, why are you doing this? The thing is, from the inside, it just looks like the drug is the only thing that's keeping you alive, and the drug is the only thing that's allowing you to cope at all. And so you perceive everything else as just like trying to take away the love of your life. And obviously people will react badly to that.
So what does this mean in terms of an institutional or public health response? You know, there are a number of different attempts to try and make a difference at this moment, you know, restricting opioid access, needle exchanges, safe injection sites. So what do you think the general public is getting right?
So here's what we need to be supporting. We have two treatments that cut the death rate by 50% or more. And those two treatments are long-term use of either methadone or buprenorphine, which the brand name is Suboxone.
Mm-hmm.
We demonize those treatments. We tell people that you're still addicted if you're on those treatments, even though we're misunderstanding that addiction is compulsive use of drugs despite negative consequences, which when you're stabilized on maintenance, you don't have. And we're confusing that with physical dependence, which means needing something to function. Needing something to function isn't necessarily a problem. Compulsive use despite negative consequences is definitely a problem. What these medications do for some people is immediately allow them to stop the compulsive behavior and to stabilize their lives and to simply get on with it. And when you're on a steady dose of these medications, you are not impaired. So the idea that people who are, you know, on these medications can't be reached emotionally or any of these other things is simply not true. You can drive, you can love, you can work, you can do all of these things. We get misconceptions about these medications because there's a second way to use them as well, which is that some people are not going to stabilize. They're going to continue to take other drugs. They will therefore continue to be high at some times. They will therefore continue to be unavailable at some times. But they are still at dramatically reduced risk of dying if they're on the medication. So the most important thing that the public can support is immediate, low threshold, like no barrier access to these medications. You walk into a doctor's office, you get it. And, you know, obviously there need to be some controls, but it the way we do it now is just far too restrictive. The other larger thing to do is locking people up for possessing a substance does not help anybody. Yeah, there's a much bigger argument to be had over whether you legalize sales of various things, but no one has ever been helped by being put in a cage for a couple of days, which is what we do for drug possession. It makes no sense to waste all that money locking up people. You know, you could say, well, oh, like, let's just put them in treatment instead. But A, we don't have treatment even for all the people who want it. And why should we be putting somebody who isn't ready in ahead of somebody who actually wants it and is sitting there on a waiting list? So we need to not criminalize it, because you can't destigmatize something that is criminal. The whole point of criminalizing drugs was to stigmatize them so that people don't do them. If you're already addicted, that's a bit too late for that. And there's actually no evidence that criminal possession penalties deter anybody. That's obviously a long-term thing, but it would make a huge difference, because we spend billions of dollars on, you know, locking people up for a few days and then setting them free and then locking them up again and then setting them free without ever helping them.
So if you are looking at social capital as capital, you know, as this resource that we have, this holding, what is the best way then to spend it?
If we motivate our civic organizations and our voting and our participation in order to guide us towards treating people more compassionately, it will increase social capital for everybody. I mean, one of the real tragedies of the overdose epidemic is that young people are dying who could have given so much. Older people are dying who could have given so much. These are not people that are useless. You know, the thing about addiction where you persist despite negative consequences, that skill is incredibly useful as long as it's not directed towards drugs. Because if you want to be a writer, you certainly have to persist despite rejection. And if you want to be an activist, you have to persist despite things really not going your way for a really long time and all sorts of stuff like that. But so we're just losing resources that we shouldn't be losing. We're losing moms and dads and sisters and brothers and cousins and people who, you know, are really kind, wonderful people. We tend to think that people with addiction are like horrible, selfish, evil people. And that is a stereotype. It's certainly the case that during active addiction, people may lie to protect their addiction. But other than that, people with addiction are no more likely to be dishonest or criminal than anyone else. There is one exception, which is people who have addiction and antisocial personality disorder. But thankfully, the vast majority of people with addiction do not have that. And it is wrong and harmful to stereotype everybody who's addicted with that brush.
Maya Solovitz, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Maya Solovitz, she's a journalist covering addiction and drugs, and you can find a link to her work at our website, which is wordofmouthradio.org.